You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at afdradio. You can also like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy from WVUD and arsenalfordemocracy.com. Joining me from Maryland and getting bumped up to full co-host status is Greg. Greg, welcome back to the program.
Ah, now you're stuck with me.
Yeah. Are you enjoying your promotion with all that that entails?
I don't really feel very different.
We threw a parade, but it was canceled because of the snowstorm.
I'm also in Maryland, so I didn't see it.
All right. So we're going to start off with a sort of interesting story that I saw in the Boston Globe. It was actually from the New York Times, which is, I feel like, a little bit ironic given the story in question. Headline was "Tiny Digital Publisher to Put Newsweek Back in Print." So for those who don't remember, venerable Newsweek publication dating back to, I believe, the 1930s, a product of the Astor Gang and the Mellons, was taken out of print within the last several years because it wasn't doing very well. Lots of, as the article says, lots of families and publishing firms had tried to turn it around unsuccessfully. I think, did it get bought out by the Daily Beast or something before they took it out of print?
I think so. And then the Daily Beast editor-in-chief took over for Newsweek.
Right, they refer to it as the online home of Newsweek or something like that.
Right.
The idea here is that their new goal is to put it back in print, which kind of seems stupid on its face, but then you dig into the article, and they actually, I felt like, had a bit of an interesting spin on it, which was they're going to sell it for the absurd price of $7.99 on newsstands. That essentially translates to they're intentionally marketing this as sort of a cachet slash luxury pitch that's going to help them get their online content featured on alongside other print things. You know, on the TV shows, they mentioned the Sunday news circuits, but any other similar context where you need that print cachet still, because that's how the traditional media world is still operating. And then they have also physical covers. They said all the politicians will like to see their faces on covers on newsstands, even if no one's really super duper buying it. So this would be a print edition luxury thing to sort of leverage their online presence. Greg, give me your initial read on this story.
I thought it was interesting in the sense that they are marketing it as this luxury item. And I think that there is a market there in the sense that, like, there are people our age that are in their early, mid, late 20s that are buying vinyl albums now, even though there are plenty of opportunities to download music legally or illegally. And there seems to be kind of this luxury nostalgia type thing going on that I think that the new owners of Newsweek are trying to tap into, because there is kind of like this
pre-90s nostalgia that leads countries to invade countries they used to own.
yes, we'll get to that later though. I mean, I think the interesting thing is that, you know, a lot of maybe some of the people that are going to start buying these $7.99 issues weren't even old enough to have a subscription to Newsweek back when Newsweek was still in print. I mean, I know I wasn't. I mean, my parents, but not me. So I definitely think that there's a market there, the luxury item. I just imagine kind of like somebody in an office, like a home office that has bookshelves full of books and a scotch and is reading, you know, an $8 Newsweek. That's kind of what, like, the thing that I'm getting.
Yeah, no, and I don't know, $7.99 seems like it's going to be pretty steep for your average dentist office waiting area. You know, anyway, they're only going to print 70,000 copies of every issue, which is definitely a lot lower, as the article says, than their peak circulation of 3 million or so. So, yeah, I do agree. I think there is a market for this, because I'm always astonished at how well these vinyl prints of things are selling.
Right.
Do you think, though, is it going to be the same, though? Because is someone going to be, I guess there's still a few people who the equivalent to, oh, but the sound quality is so much better on the vinyl. there's going to be these people who are like, oh, it's just not the same when you're holding your iPad on the subway or whatever. I guess there are those people. I don't know. I'm a little bit skeptical, but I agree with your take on it. This is sort of a similar vibe, and maybe it will work. Maybe they have a point about the way that this works. You kind of have a little niche thing, but then the online presence, which is going to be a much less expensive subscription, they said, that's going to be kind of where the real stuff is happening. But they,
I'm excited
but
for
they
it.
Have that, I think it's cool. That physical flagship sort of.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it'll be a cool thing. I think that we'll have to just keep our eyes open, report back on the first time we see a Newsweek that is, you know, an $8.99 version in somebody's hands. Maybe I'll even do like an off-the-cuff interview or something. I'm interested to see how that works out.
Critical insights of the hard copy Newsweek.
Who are you and why did you buy this?
Are you okay?
You can get that online, right?
No. But yeah, all kidding aside, I think, yeah, it's an interesting idea and it will be interesting to see what happens from here. What are your thoughts though on kind of wider perspective in terms of online presence versus print editions of things and books and all that? I mean, I guess that's, you know, a big can of worms, but it's something that's certainly a topic that comes up quite a bit. You know, lots of hand-wringing, from some sectors, lots of people embracing the new wave, you know, maybe a little too enthusiastically. So what's your take on the wider future of print?
Oh, I'm a total convert. I mean, like, I get all of my news online. I read all of my books on my e-reader. I mean, I really wouldn't be able to read some of the books that I'm able to read if I didn't have that built-in dictionary. Yeah, I mean, I really, really, really dig kind of the electronification of old media. I think it's a good thing, something that has enabled people to disseminate their ideas more easily. I do think that based on sometimes how democratic it is, that there is probably more stuff that's not as worthwhile online. And I think that that's perhaps something that Newsweek is trying to combat, because with the $7.99 sticker price for however many copies that they're going to print weekly, they're probably going to have some money to do some pretty serious investigative reporting. And I think that's a good thing. But I also...
And on the flip side, it would show that they are actually willing to invest some capital in their other content too, you know, if they're willing to go to the money and expense and everything of printing print copies, then they're obviously showing some level of dedication that's not necessarily matched by an online only thing.
Right. I mean, I think that that's probably one of the drawbacks of the digitization of old media, is that just there are news organizations that just are either unwilling or unable to invest the amount of time and money and effort into producing these really, really high quality pieces. And not to say that it's not happening at all, but I think that when it is happening, it's in large part on the initiative of the journalists. I mean, I know that journalists are out there, they're going to get stories and they're not expensed like they used to. So if you want to go somewhere, maybe you have to pay for your own ticket, and maybe you have to pay for your hotel, and maybe you have to find your own contacts. So there, I mean, there's obviously a trade-off. It's, you know, you get read by a bunch more people, but then there's, on the flip side of that, this pressure to make a lot of content, and in doing that you have to spend less time on each individual piece. And so, I mean, it's a very complicated issue.
To kind of rip it even wider open, just thinking, you know, bouncing off of what you're saying, a lot of the issue has to do with the revenue model being disrupted. Something that came up when I was studying the advertising course that I took back at our alma mater, the professor talked about how there had been kind of the revelation of online media was that the advertisers, or rather the people paying for the advertisements, suddenly realized and had a way of measuring just how little impact those ads made. And so they realized they were paying way too much for these print editions. I mean, you know, we're well past the Mad Men heyday of this ad is going to change everything or whatever. I think, you know, important to note that people are not necessarily fixed in how they perceive things. So it may be and probably was the case that, say, 60, 70 years ago, advertising in print would make a huge dent because there wasn't as much advertising in general bombarding you constantly. So it was easier to break through and it was more novel and you maybe weren't as skeptical or cynical about the advertising as a lot of people are now. But ultimately, a lot of the problems faced by the industry now do tie back to this revenue model being disrupted and then not quite figuring out how to monetize it online, which is something that I think we've been thinking about at Arsenal for Democracy as well. But this feeling that I'm having is like, how does this fit into the broader sort of post-industrial narrative of how all, revenues are derived in general? Things are being automated, things are being computerized, that puts people out of work in the short term, and for those people that's a bad thing, but there are lots of benefits, of course, that come from the automation and the computerization as a result. Those are undeniably good things on a macro scale for society and the economy, or I think they're undeniably good. I guess some people might argue, but in general, I think it's going to raise standards of living and that sort of thing. But then people wonder about, okay, but what if you computerize so many things, you know, or the revenue models all change and how people get paid changes. And then what do you do from there? Are you going to have lots of people unemployed? I think the kind of optimist view on that is that in all likelihood, that's going to push people sort of like a new version of the division of labor that followed the agricultural revolution. You know, in that case, that was, you know, Neolithic people figuring out, oh, wait, we don't need everyone to work in the fields because we're making enough crops to feed the whole society. So instead of having people redundantly working or just being unemployed, some of those people are going to be, oh, I can go make some pottery and then I'll sell you the pottery in exchange for some of your grain because I didn't grow it myself. And so the idea here would be you'd have a second kind of version, or third, depending on how you count it, where a lot more people become sort of crafty, artisan, creative types and go into that as their business model. And that obviously people would have to have a greater demand for that so that the people who still have the money are able to buy that. And then you get into issues of worrying about concentration of wealth, because you obviously do need it to be not very concentrated in order for everyone to still be able to have an opportunity to purchase from these folks.
I just think overall, it's really interesting that it's taken this long for news media and just all media in general to work a new revenue model. I mean, this revenue model has been failing for a while, right? And it's just kind of been like a train that's been running on the coal that's been on board, and it's had enough coal, I guess, from, you know, hundreds, 200, 300 years of this kind of, well, ad revenue
probably
generation.
Only 100 for based on this particular,
yeah,
model.
I suppose that's right. I don't think that Benjamin Franklin was necessarily soliciting the same types of ads for Poor Richard's Almanac, but
bye.
Yeah, I do think that it's interesting that it's taken so long for them to figure it out. I mean, it was a pretty large jump to get from everything in print to everything in electronic form. But people adapted to that really quickly. But then just the revenue, how did it take so long? I mean, really, it just boggles my mind how we still haven't really figured out how to make money off of this, or to make money like we used to. And perhaps there will never be a time when the profits that were seen from the old print media with advertisements and the Mad Men type thing that we're talking about, perhaps we're never going to see that again.
Right.
It's possible. But I just think it's really interesting that it's taken us as a people a while to figure out how we're going to keep this train going forward.
Right. It could certainly be the case that it ends up being a sort of profit neutral model or something like that. But yeah, not a lot of innovation going on. Some of these things, it's a bit puzzling where the money's actually coming from. And somehow they either manage to make it work, or they just can figure out how to carry the losses over until they can stick them with someone else or flip the company to a new owner.
Yeah. But overall, what do we think on Newsweek going back into print? I think it's adorably quaint.
We'll go with that.
Okay.
Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. You're
listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Past co-host and now our European correspondent Persephone filed a report this week from Belgium, giving us an update on the Spanish abortion law controversy.
This is Persephone. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Today I'm going to present a small segment on abortion rights in Spain. Now, several episodes back, we talked about the Partido Popular, Spain's popular party, and their conservative social policy. This is embodied in the new abortion law they've been trying to push through, the Ley Gallardón. So just to reiterate briefly, this law would make Spain one of the strictest member states of the EU where abortion is concerned. Not only would a woman need to have her life at risk to get an abortion, she would need notes from two separate doctors attesting to the necessity of the procedure. So talk about, you know, paternalizing. Not only does a woman have to have her life at risk to even consider getting this procedure done, she also needs two separate notes. So you can easily imagine how difficult it would be for a woman who finds out that her pregnancy is putting her life at risk and she will need an abortion to save her life. And she finds out that not only does she have to go to her first doctor, she has to go get a second separate doctor, you know, and if this is an emergency procedure, I mean, that's a pretty big risk. I mean, you're putting women's lives at risk. But in addition to this, in cases of rape, the woman would have to report the crime of rape in order to be able to qualify for an abortion. Now, they also take a page out of the American Republican handbook because women would have to go through a 7-day waiting period and they would also have to undergo counseling. So again, let's consider the situation of the woman whose life is at risk from her pregnancy, who is forced to undergo this waiting period. And, you know, I mean, we're literally talking about the potential for women to die because of this new law, not just from unsafe abortions, which is a risk anytime abortion restrictions are enacted, but literally because of the law, because the law says we do not care if your life is in danger. The fetus is more important, even if the fetus won't survive either. So it's just kind of, it's astounding to me that this could even pass. Now, this bill has not passed yet, but it's very upsetting. I'm just kind of concerned, and I feel very bad for women in Spain, especially women under the age of 18, because women from 16 to 18 have to get their parents' permission before getting an abortion. Now, new things brought to the table. El País's Trans-Iberian blog, which is an English language blog that reports on Spanish news, they point out that all of this is probably going to result in a rise in quote-unquote abortion tourism, so kind of like what exists currently between the Republic of Ireland and the United Kingdom. Ireland's laws about abortion are very, very strict, and so women have to go to the United Kingdom if they want to get an abortion. But of course, as the blog points out, this can't be taken advantage of by many Spaniards because it's a pretty expensive procedure. You'd have to fly out. You'd have to take time off of work probably because it's even more expensive on weekends if you can find a clinic that's open. And, you know, Spain isn't exactly in the best financial circumstances. So a lot of people just aren't going to have the money for any of this. And of course, a lot of these parties, you know, whether in the States or in Europe, don't really care about that because if it's ever somebody in their family, they have the money to send their wives, their daughters to other countries to get the procedure done. So it's complete hypocrisy, but it does happen. Now, what does Gallardón, the minister for whom the act is named, have to say about this? So he says that it's about the so-called right to maternity. Now, I don't think I need to deconstruct just how bogus this term and this idea is, because having abortion be legal doesn't force anybody to get them. But in any case, regardless of how stupid this is, the public will is completely against this. The vast majority of Spanish citizens think that the current reform that would restrict the rights is completely unnecessary, and people are very upset about this. There are mass protests. As a matter of fact, even some Partido Popular politicians have spoken up against this proposed law, including José Antonio Monago, who's in Extremadura, which is in the southwest. So according to the BBC, he said that, quote, "No one can deny the right of a woman to become a mother, nor can they oblige her to become one." So kind of a play on this ridiculous right to maternity thing totally deconstructs that, and the whole situation is pretty much ridiculous. Now, in terms of public feedback, there's actually been an interesting development. I talked about in depth on arsenalfordemocracy.com in an article, which is that Femen, the women's rights group that is best known for their topless protests in Tunisia, have decided to get involved. So that's just an update. It's very interesting to see how people are responding. And it's honestly, it's pretty heartening to see this level of protest and this level of people being upset over it. And I don't know if this will be effective. I don't know if it certainly seems like some members of the Partido Popular are going to go against the party vote, which is pretty unusual in Spanish politics. But it's hard to say whether it will be enough to keep this from becoming law.
Arsenal for Democracy will return in a moment for WVUD and arsenalfordemocracy.com. You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Back on now with me again is co-host Greg. Greg, we're going to talk now about the situation in Crimea. I think we can shorthand it, especially with how fast things have been moving, by just saying if you need the actual news part, you go look online like we directed people last episode. But if you need the analysis part and discussion part of the wider context, right here on Arsenal for Democracy, that's where you go.
Stick around.
I think, you know, obviously the wide context that a lot of Americans are interested in is this Russia versus U.S. dynamic, but there's plenty of other angles. I think there's been a long and unfortunate history of U.S. antagonism toward Russia kind of needlessly, but then always acting like we're the ones that are the offended party or the party that's been acted against, which I'm not saying to be all unpatriotic and whatever. I'm just saying, like, let's look at this realistically, or at least, at the very least, we have to be willing to consider when both parties have nuclear weapons, we have to think about how is the other country viewing this thing. And countries don't necessarily view things from your perspective. Every country's, you know, political culture is different too. There was a lot of misunderstandings in the Cold War because people in the U.S. would be thinking, oh, the Russians will react to this thing this way. And then the Russians were thinking of it a different way. There was a really kind of great illustrative but fictional thing. I think it might have been based on reality, but it's hard to know. On the FX show, The Americans, in season one, there's a thing, you know, in passing, the assassination attempt on Reagan that has nothing to do with them, obviously. It was a crazy guy, as everyone knows. But the Russians were convinced in the show that this meant there was a military coup in progress in the United States, right? And to all the Americans, this was absurd. But this was a discussion between the Russian spy characters on the show, was like, well, you know, the Secretary of State is a former military general, and he just said that he's in charge of the White House, so this means there's been a military coup. And then one of the other characters says, no, I don't think so. I think that Americans are a little bit more, you know, fixed on the balance of power between the civilian and military parts of the government, and they also are a little bit more procedural about how the succession happens and things like that, and they don't react to crises in the way that our home leadership does, right? And that might be fictional, but that's like a good illustration of how you can look at something, the same thing, from two different perspectives and come away from it with totally different views. So of course, you know, the U.S. perspective is, oh, Russia's invading a former territory and is threatening a democratic people, are trying to seize land. And hey, some of that might be true, but let's also just keep in mind that from the Russian perspective, the U.S. has been trying to build missile defense systems all over Eastern Europe that they believe are directed at them, despite the U.S. claims. And again, it doesn't really matter what the facts are as much as what the perception is, because perception is what actually shapes how people react in situations like this. And similarly, trying to get all these former Soviet countries into the European Union and into NATO, those countries have their own interests for doing that. The US and NATO members have their own interest in doing that. But the Russian perspective is that they're being encircled, so to speak. And then you get all the really problematic old school Cold War rhetoric from the United States that's really not helpful. And I know Greg's going to quote a few of those. The one one that really bothered me in particular, and you can read my full rant about that on arsenalfordemocracy.com, is the John McCain quote, "We are all Ukrainians now," right before Russia invaded Ukraine the other day. Now, this is a mirror of his quote from 2008. I believe it was August 2008 during the Summer Olympics in China, and this was when Russia went to war with Georgia, but it's a little bit disputed how it started, but officially, Georgia attacked Russia. Little Georgia in the Caucasus Mountains attacked humongous nuclear-armed Russia. It did not go very well for Georgia, as you might imagine. And they argue that they were provoked into it, and there's reasonable evidence that they were, but they did, in fact, attack first officially. And John McCain, then running for president, supposed to be this foreign policy expert, and, you know, that he would be cool, calm, and collected in a crisis on foreign policy or something, he said that he told his friend, the president of Georgia, he said, "I told him that we are all Georgians today." Well, A, you're not our president, and B, who authorized you to speak on behalf of the American people and identify with people who just very stupidly decided to attack Russia? So he's back at it again with this Ukraine thing. We are all Ukrainians today. I actually hadn't realized this until like last week, but he actually made a live in-person address to the protesters back in December, definitely throwing in his lot with them, even though some of them are a little bit questionable. I just think it's interesting that he's taken this perspective, and it's this, and he kept on talking about how, oh, we got it. Putin's a Cold War spy chess master, and we got to think of him like that. And it's like, yeah, but what if that's not how he's thinking of it? What if he's, you know, got a completely different mindset? The Cold War is over, and it is possible to consider things from different angles than the Cold War framework, but people like John McCain really just are bent into this Cold War rigidity that they cannot break out of, and they keep on trying to force us into this dynamic. And sometimes you have to be prepared, like in the case of Georgia, which he wasn't, to say, look, you messed up. You shouldn't have attacked Russia. Even if they were daring you to, you don't do it. You just don't do it. It's a bad idea. And they suffered very badly because of it. Georgia basically took the bait. Here in Ukraine didn't try to really bait Russia. But of course, from Russia's perspective, they did just throw out the Russian-speaking president of Ukraine. And Russia doesn't really recognize the legitimacy of that. And then there's the Russian population of mostly ex-Soviet retirees in Crimea, who only make up slightly more than half the population in that region. But there's also the Russian naval base. And so Russia looks at this and maybe thinks that there's going to be mass reprisals happening. You know, there were some allegations that there had been neo-Nazis involved in these pro-Western protests in Ukraine. So if you're Russia and you're looking at that perspective and you have a history of persecuting your ethnic minorities, you might also expect your population in these other countries to be oppressed. So this is not to excuse or justify. It's just to say, let's take a look at this from multiple angles. Greg, what were some of the quotes that you wanted to highlight in this situation?
Well, going off of your discussion of perspective, I thought it was interesting that the New York Times reported on March 2nd that Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany spoke with Vladimir Putin. Chancellor Angela Merkel informed President Obama that she was, quote, not sure if he was in touch with reality. And she also said he was, quote, in another world, which is a bit disconcerting when you're talking about leader of a nation that has nuclear weapons. You know, this may or may not be propaganda to make him appear irrational or what have you. But certainly, it was an interesting thing to come out of this article. In addition to that, there are some perspectives that I thought were interesting and possibly problematic from our very own senators. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican from South Carolina, in response to the escalation in Russia, quote, create a democratic noose around Putin's Russia, which Bill and I are not sure what that means at all. And we had a good laugh about that before the recording of this show. And there was a quote from Senator Marco Rubio, obviously the Republican from Florida and presidential hopeful, that we should revisit the missile defense shield, which I suppose if your objective is to escalate to war, then that would be a great idea. But I don't think that that's what we want to do. Representative Mike Rogers from Michigan, Republican, said that we should cancel Sochi. Obviously, he's referring to the impending G8 summit in Sochi, Russia. at this point, it's sort of moot because all countries that are that were supposed to go to the G8 summit have pulled out, with the exception of Russia, because they're going to be there because it's their country. And then finally, there was a quote from Senator Richard J. Durbin of Illinois, Democratic whip, who said that we should kick them out of the G8 altogether, which I don't know if we have the power to do that unilaterally. I suppose that we could bring that up, but I don't think that the United States could start the initiative, I suppose, but I'm not sure. I mean, Bill, you might have some greater insight into this, but I'm not sure what the procedure would be to kick Russia out of the G8 and create a G7.
I don't exactly know either, but it's not impossible.
I wouldn't think so.
They did invite Russia basically in the 1990s to join the G7 and make it the G8 in the first place, not because of the size of Russia's economy, but because of their geopolitical power and influence, as well as to make them feel better about their super hurt feelings from having the Soviet Union break up and then leaving their empire in dust. But that's a good bridge point too, as well as this idea that the Russian perspective or the Putin perspective is not necessarily rational, as we've, you know, as Angela Merkel argued, which is that there may be reasons that explain why Russia is doing this, but that does not make it a particularly well thought out plan. Maybe we can't see where he's going with it, but it seems like he's trying to bring back former gems of the Russian Empire back under the sway of Russia to sort of complete his agenda of recreating Imperial Russia. This is not a recreation of the Soviet Union. This is more of a recreation of the old Russian Empire, and Crimea was one of those gems because it was very hard fought for the Russians to conquer from the native populations and the Ottomans, with whom they were typically aligned. The Crimean War didn't go very well for Russia against an unusual allied force combination of the Ottoman Empire, the French Empire, and the British Empire. And with great loss of life, as many people know, that was one of the first, right before the Civil War, that was one of the first really modern battles where you had a lot of the new technology that was super good at killing people on a large scale, but you were still using the old school tactics. And of course, unfortunately, they were also still using them by 1914. But the other thing that's notable about the Crimean War, because it's in hindsight seems sort of pointless and really oddly specific, you know, unlike, say, a world war, which is over a wide area and involves all these major powers. It's kind of this was over a very narrow thing and probably should have been resolved some other way. But that's just how they thought they were supposed to do things then. The casualties, there more than half of the deaths, I believe, in the Crimean War were not battle deaths. They were disease related, and not even necessarily people who, you know, were wounded and then died. In many cases, it was just straight up getting sick and dying from other things. So, you know, a pretty pointless war here. Hopefully not a repeat situation, of course. But yeah, Russia has a long history with this peninsula, but a lot of the history is about the subjugation of this peninsula. It's about deporting the Crimean Tartar population to Central Asia, like they did with so many of these other ethnic and generally Muslim minority groups, like the Circassians and the Chechens and any number of these other groups. The Russian strategy, and of course this is something that the United States and other countries have pursued all over the world, is, you know, you pick certain ethnic minorities. Russia picked the Cossacks, for example. You favor those, and then you deport or destroy all the other groups. And, you know, Russia is not by any means solely at fault for this, but the Soviet Union continued this policy pretty extensively well into the 20th century and even into the second half of the 20th century, and in doing so decimated or even wiped out and eliminated and annihilated some of these populations. I talked about on the radio show before about the Chechen deportations. I talked about on the blog about the Circassian deportations, which were mostly done through the port city of Sochi, where the G8 was supposed to be held and where the Olympics, of course, were just held. But this is something that the Russians kind of sweep under the rug in terms of, oh, Ukraine was the heartland of, you know, outer Russia, and everyone should be part of Russia, and the Crimea is filled with Russians. It's like, well, it was at the time that you had the naval base there, which they still do, and the overwhelming number of Soviet retirees and ex-military people down there. But then, of course, that's now only half the population, because a lot of the Tartars came back from Central Asia and very much want to be part of an independent Ukraine, perhaps even an independent Crimea, but probably part of Ukraine for their own safety reasons. And they definitely don't want to be part of Russia. And the peninsula has also become infrastructurally dependent. There was a whole article on that at Slate by Mary Mycio. And she argues that you got the dual problems that Putin's going to face about dealing with a potential Tartar insurgency, which would be yet another Muslim ethnic minority insurgency in a former Russian imperial area like the Caucasus Mountains in Chechnya, Dagestan, all these other, Ingushetia, all these places. The other thing, just infrastructurally, as I said, that there's a lot of connection in terms of power lines and water lines and things like that, and energy coming from mainland Ukraine across the little isthmus that connects the peninsula and prevents it from being an island. It's relatively close to another part of Russia as well, but not as close and not connected by land. So unless Putin's prepared to build up an entire support system at great cost, and meanwhile facing all the economic and political fallout from this action, this is not going to go as well as he thinks, and is a very strange, kind of irrational, hyper-nationalistic move that seems like a bad call to me. I'm also just curious about why they don't just, if they're so concerned about, and this is something we talked about on episode 56, about these so-called peacekeeping interventions that Russia periodically stages in its peripheral areas of the former Russian Empire and Soviet Union, if they're so concerned about these transplant Russian populations that they settled as an intentional policy of Russifying these places to prevent them from reverting back to their ethnic identity that was non-Russian, they need to move these populations into Russia, which is going to be extremely disruptive because those people are, you know, in many cases from Ukraine now, right? But if they are genuinely that concerned about these people's safety, then they need to move them back to Russia, because you don't see France continually trying to stage interventions in independent Algeria to protect its native populations. Why? Because there's almost none of the French population left in Algeria, because they had a program that moved 800,000 people back to France in a number of years. Those were the Pieds Noirs people. And those people were not born in France. It was extremely disruptive to their lives. And they, you know, don't necessarily feel at home in France, because that's not where they're from either. But they also weren't, you know, they were born in Algeria, but were not of Algeria, and were part of the active effort to brutally suppress the Algerian independence movement. The French Republic ended up switching sides during the war for independence from their own folks, their you know, white European French Algerians, over to the native Algerian population, the non-French Algerian population. And that was, like Crimea or Ukraine, that was not an overseas colony. That was an actual part of France. It was organized. Algeria was organized as a department of France, like any other state in mainland France, right? And these people had been there for generations in many cases, and then they were moved back because they had been part of this rebellion against France for having switched to supporting the independence cause. But you know what? That had all these negative consequences, but at least now France doesn't have to keep going into Algeria to, quote unquote, protect its population, because they moved these people. So if that's really the concern, Russia needs to move these people from the Crimea into Russia. But I don't think that's really the solution either, because these people, frankly, in my opinion, need to learn to get along better and figure out how to make it work despite their problematic history. It's not something we do perfectly in the U.S. by any means either. We still have many, many problems with both our native populations and our black populations descended from the people that we were enslaving, but we're sort of figuring out a way to make it work. And at the very least, there's no ongoing, at this particular moment, mass intentional political campaign of genocide or anything like that. There's a lot of problems, but there's no elected party openly advocating for a Bosnian-style genocide. And that is a fortunate sign that we are at least somehow partially making it work. And that would be better, I think, than trying to break away certain parts or create these weird puppet states or even moving the population back into Russia. So a lot to think about there. I know I've been going on too long, but I'll let Greg Greg respond now.
Yeah, I think that you touched on a point that I wanted to kind of touch on, because especially, I mean, obviously there's been a lot of condemnation, at least in the U.S. media, about how Russia is handling this Ukraine situation. And then I think there's been a lot of counter narrative that said, like, oh, where does the U.S. come off saying things like that? And it got me thinking about, like, you know, capital T truth, not just like truth, but capital T truth, which may or may not exist, but just like what is actually the right thing or what is actually factual and whatnot. And does capital T truth as a message change on who is the messenger? So in a sense, so what I'm basically trying to say is that are American criticisms of Russia invalidated because of how we treat our own ethnic minorities, because of our interventions in Central and South America? I think it's an interesting thing to point out. I think that it's possible, especially if somebody gets really sanctimonious about what Russia is doing, to remind them that, you know, the United States does not have a completely clean record on similar doing similar things. But at the same time, I think that objectively we can say, like, this is not something that Russia should be doing, regardless of what we have done in our past as Americans.
Right. I agree with that perspective. I've definitely been one of the people who's been pointing out various parallels, you know, that the interventions by Russia in its quote-unquote sphere of influence, the former Soviet Union and former Russian Empire territories, is similar to U.S. quote-unquote Monroe Doctrine interventions, where this is the U.S.'s sphere. No one else is allowed to intervene, but we can intervene, and we will intervene, and we will protect American interests. It's very similar to the protect Russian interests line that we're hearing right now. And certainly, you know, if there's been any change of governments or coups or whatever that we aren't responsible for, we usually react very negatively to that. But of course, you know, we've got 1983 into Grenada, we've got 1989 into Panama, various, you know, things that aren't that far in the past. Those, of course, are still in the Cold War era. But as recently as 2002, we tried to overthrow the democratically elected government of Venezuela. I agree with you that this is, it's fair to point out that the U.S. is not flawless, certainly, and we need to be mindful of those things. But at the same time, it is also true that what Russia is doing is not acceptable and should be condemned. It's just don't get too carried away with it or try to make this about how the U.S. is so great and Russia is so terrible. That dichotomy is really greatly exaggerated, I think. And I also, as I said earlier, I think it's important to, at the very least, consider the perspective that Russia is looking at this from, not to excuse or justify it, but just so we understand, try to get in that mindset where this maybe makes sense, so that we don't just have some unreasonable knee-jerk reaction or do something stupid like trying to put more missile sites into Eastern Europe when, you know, their response has consistently been to put nuclear missile batteries into Kaliningrad, which is in the heart of Europe. It's that weird exclave on the Baltic Sea that they kept to have another port. And I think the other thing that's just kind of been bothering me, and I don't know if it's been bothering you, and we won't go into too much detail on it, but this thing that I have realized the irony of saying this, but kind of everyone suddenly becoming a Crimea expert, right? Yeah. I mean, a lot of this I was already well aware of, and, you know, some of these things I had been writing about since before there was any relevance to them, really. But, you know, I'm certainly not an expert. Just really bold claims that you see made, like, oh, this has always been Russian, or Russia gave Crimea to Ukraine. No, they didn't. Crimea voted for staying with Ukraine, and the Soviets, you know, administratively moved around stuff all the time between different republics and, you know, different territories, regions were sometimes traded back and forth because it was easier to administrate them from a different place. But Crimea has long been a core part of the Ukrainian multi-ethnic identity and concept, such as it was. And it's not some, you know, magical gift from Russia. And it's certainly not Russian then, Russian now, Russian forever, because they removed and killed off a lot of the native population of the peninsula and then put their own people in there and then forced everyone to speak Russian.
I think that that's a point well said. And that's why I've kind of tried to hesitate to make any bold declarations about what's going to happen. I really don't know what's going to happen. I think that if Putin is in fact, like Angela Merkel said, in his own world and or in another world, then we need to get in that world. We need to understand what world he is in that is dictating what his decisions have been over the past
week and a half.
Well, not even necessarily over the past week and a half, but if you want to go all the way back to perhaps like in October or November, when he was presumably putting a lot of pressure on, if you become closely allied with Europe, then we're going to withdraw support from you. And which would have been, again, as we talked about, economically devastating.
To Ukraine, yeah.
Right, right, exactly. So I think that I hesitate to make any statement about what's going to happen because it's difficult for me right. to get
by the time this
world.
Episode airs right. something different than we expect will have happened, but
right.
you know, we just want to provide kind of a bird's eye view analysis on in context on this situation.
Right.
Well, Greg, thank you for joining me once again here on Arsenal for Democracy. Great discussion this week, and I'm sure that we will all be joined back up again next week and also have Nate on board as well.
Pleasure as always.
That's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for March 3rd, 2014. The show is recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts weekly and is usually available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear a repeat of it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Outside Delaware, you can stream it from WVUD.org at the same time. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow Justin's work at the digitized ramblings of an 8-bit animal from 8bitanimal.com. You can get additional commentary every day at arsenalfordemocracy.com. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.